I'm Lisa DeLay, and you're listening to the Spark My Muse podcast. Welcome, everybody, to Spark My Muse. I am very delighted to have Professor Ibram Kendi. He is a New York Times bestselling author, an award-winning historian who teaches at the University of Florida, and we will be discussing his second book called Stamped from the Beginning, The Definitive History of Racist Ideas in America. It recently won the 2016 National Book Award for Nonfiction, a wonderful accomplishment. It's well-deserved. I've just been reading some of it now, and it's just an incredibly full-bodied, well-researched portrayal of racism, how it came to America. And thank you so much for joining me today, Dr. Kendi.
Well, thank you for having me on your show.
Usually I start out the program asking people where, how they were formed spiritually or religiously, or just big influences on their lives in terms of mentors. And I know your parents probably played a great deal of influence in your life. And maybe you could talk a little bit about what it was like growing up for you.
Sure. So yeah, both of my parents were deeply religious and ministers, especially my father was a minister. My mother joined the ministry later, but they both came out of what was known in the late 60s, or more so early 70s, as the Black Theology Movement, which was a more sort of community-oriented form of Christianity that was, of course, focused on sort of improving and advancing human life, and so literally going beyond the church. And so, you know, for them, and I guess for me, you know, I came up in a household where social justice and racial justice issues were sort of table talk, and that I was able to sort of see my parents involved in this type of work. And so I think, you know, from birth, I was sort of exposed to people who were trying to solve the major problems, you know, of our society. And so I think, of course, you know, that sort of cradle was very important for my own personal development.
You weren't just talking about it, but you were seeing it lived out right in front of you.
Yes.
Well, your book is called Stamped from the Beginning, and that title has a great deal of meaning that I hope you might be able to unpack and explain a little bit. It's a very powerful title. Do you mind going into that?
Sure. And so first, the actual words themselves come from a speech that Jefferson Davis gave on the floor of the U.S. Senate in 1860, when he was still a senator from Mississippi before he became the president of the Confederacy. And in this speech, he was basically opposing a bill that would have provided funding for education of Black people in Washington, D.C. And so he stated basically that, you know, the inequality between the white and Black races was stamped from the beginning. And then curiously, he went on to prove to his colleagues why, and basically sort of narrated this Southern, or I should say pro-slavery folklore known as the Land of Nod sort of fairy tale. In this story of the Land of Nod, Cain is excommunicated from the Garden of Eden, and he goes to the Land of Nod. And in this Land of Nod were not only animals, but the beings that, according to this theory, God created along with the animals before humans or before whites, which were Black people. And according to this theory, Cain, as the, quote, world's first criminal, human criminal, basically went to a place that suited him. And so in a sense, Black people were like devilish criminals. And I think it's indicative of this, of the fact that ever since the founding of this nation, Black people have been stamped from the beginning as criminals. Because when Black people were resisting enslavement, that was illegal. And so they were deemed criminals. When they ran away, they were fugitives. And of course, we know the way in which blackness has still been stamped, become the stamp for criminality.
And your book also goes into the construct of race as being something that came about as a way of basically justifying the slave trade, and it was concocted because, I mean, your book really goes into this. This is a fascinating evolution of a hatred of certain people groups in terms of like starting with, like, as you say, policies first and of self-interest, and then backing those up with notions about certain people groups. And maybe you can go into a little bit about some of how the idea of race even began. I mean, obviously, this is a big chunk of your book, so you can't really do it. But in terms of, people take for granted that there is such a thing as race, when not realizing that this was something concocted for profit.
Yeah, and so, you know, I think the idea of, quote, Black Africa or even white Europe, these are modern constructions. These are constructions that came about as a result of, specifically, as you stated, the slave trade. And so, you know, I chronicled the entire history of racist ideas. And that history begins with a writer by the name of Gomes Zurara. And Gomes Zurara was a Portuguese writer, and he was charged in the 1450s with writing a biography of Prince Henry. Who was Prince Henry? Prince Henry was basically the pioneering slave trader of African sort of people. The first, he sort of led or organized and spearheaded the expeditions from Portugal down the Atlantic and into West Africa, which was really sort of pioneering for Western Europe, because they had before that primarily received African slaves through the sub-Saharan slave trade and Muslim sort of middlemen. And so he, of course, had to justify why it was that Prince Henry and Portugal, more Portuguese slave traders more broadly, began this sort of commerce in the slave trading of African people in particular, like the exclusive slave trading in African people, while other slave traders were slave trading in African people and Islamic people and Eastern European Slavs. It was the Portuguese that really were the first to exclusively slave trade in African people. And he, in order to make that justification, he had to justify why they were slave trading all of these different ethnic groups. And so he, in his book, in his biography of Prince Henry, in his esteeming biography of Prince Henry, he basically classified all of these different groups as one people and as one inferior people. And as one inferior people that was going to be civilized by coming to Portugal and by basically their own enslavement.
And also was done under the guise of saving people under the Christian missionary work as well. I mean, that was kind of co-opted into this sort of imperial missionary work.
Exactly. So one element of civilization, of course, was Christianity. And so, you know, and that, of course, then allowed for Portuguese slave trading to be endorsed by the Pope. Mm. Course was a crucial endorsement that they needed in order to continue their commerce in the mid-1400s.
One of the defining characteristics of your book is that you set up these five different tour guides, which makes the book very narrative and not like a stuffy academic book or anything like that. Even though it's 600 pages, you take us through with different people and bring these stories come to life. And I really appreciate that about your book. Nobody should be intimidated to read it. It actually makes for a really quick and interesting reading. And maybe you can talk a little bit about, if you don't mind, why you picked the particular people that you did. I'm sure some of it has to do with the time periods in which these people lived, but were there any people that you picked really specifically that, oh, this person has to be in there?
So I think I the five major characters that sort of represent the five major sections of the book are, of course, the first major character. It was a Boston theologian by the name of Cotton Mather, who lived from about the 1660s to the 1720s. And he was really the first great American intellectual and theologian. And the second major character needs no introduction, Thomas Jefferson. The third major character was William Lloyd Garrison, who was the most famous white male abolitionist. And then the fourth major character was W.E.B. Du Bois, who, of course, is one of the more important black scholars and activists in history. And then the final character in the last section was Angela Davis. And so I chose these characters for a number of different reasons. And first and foremost, actually, time period was very important. So their lives sort of bracketed critical periods in American history. And so for colonial America, up until really the sort of roots of the American Revolution was, of course, Cotton Mather, and then Jefferson from 1743 until 1826. And 1826 was really the eve of the abolitionist movement, which emerged through the likes of Garrison, who died after the fall of Reconstruction. And then Du Bois's section picks up with America, in sort of after Reconstruction. And then his section goes from, he actually dies on the eve of the March on Washington. And Davis's section runs from that day until the present. But then each of these figures were also really at the center of these major debates on race in America. And also their lives and ideas were also quite fascinating and interesting.
Mm. And you talk about three concepts of race in terms of segregationist, assimilationist, and anti-racist. And this is woven in and through the book in different aspects, sometimes well-intentioned, but also to most of the time doing very great damage and creating a lot of setbacks. And for people who wouldn't understand those terms and what they mean, maybe you could unpack them.
Sure. So there's two ways to understand these terms. First and foremost, in a very sort of direct way. So segregationists historically have made the case that Black people are inferior by nature and therefore permanently inferior. Assimilationists have historically stated that Black people are inferior by nurture because of their environment, and therefore they can be civilized and developed. So it's more of a temporary inferiority, and they've tried to sort of civilize and develop Black people. While anti-racists have stated that Black people are not inferior, neither by nature or nurture. So that's one way to understand those three different perspectives. Another way to understand them is to recognize that really throughout the course of American history, there's been three major positions that have sought to understand and explain the causes of racial disparities and racial problems in our society. And so segregationists have principally blamed Black people and their inferiority and stated that these problems and these inequities are permanent. Anti-racists, thinking or believing that the racial groups are equal, have stated that racial discrimination is the cause. And assimilationists have sort of taken a middle road. They stated that both, it is the case that Black people are inferior because of their environment, but that environment is largely tied to racial discrimination. And so they emphasized and challenged both racial discrimination and Black inferiorities.
One of the points in your book that was so striking to me is how assimilationists can really unknowingly or unwittingly hold a lot of racist ideas that they don't realize because of the idea of thinking that assimilation is the norm. For instance, the white norm, white is normal, and anything else is inferior. And that's a really prevalent thing that you see that doesn't seem maybe to a lot of people as racist, but it really is very. Of course, if you take a closer look at it, it is. And I was very touched by your honesty. As you say in the beginning of your book, fooled by racist ideas, I did not fully realize that the only thing wrong with Black people is that we think something is wrong with Black people. And this has been a journey for you in writing the book, and maybe you can explain a little bit of that.
Well, one of the ironies, I think, about our society is that almost everyone currently would state that they are, quote, not racist. But then if you ask people, so what is a racist idea? I think people struggle to answer that question. And that's the irony. Like, we're so fervently not something, but then we don't necessarily know what that something is. And I think that's indicative of American history. And I have yet to come across a group of articulators of racist ideas who were willing to admit that their ideas were racist. And so I think with that being said, you know, I wanted to sort of, at the most basic level in entering into this book, define a racist idea. Mm. And I thought it was very critical to doing so. So people can understand, okay, are my ideas about Black people racist or not? Okay, here's the definition and let me apply them to them. I ended up defining a racist idea as any idea that suggests a racial group is superior or inferior to another racial group in any way. And so clearly, Stamped from the Beginning was about racist ideas about Black people. And so, you know, I sort of chronicled all of these ideas suggesting that there was something wrong with the Black racial group. And so once I decided on that definition, which to me encompassed all of these different ideas classifying Black people as inferior, I first and foremost had to recognize that I had consumed those types of ideas over the course of my lifetime. And it was interesting because as I was sort of interrogating and discovering and largely trying to discard my own internalized racist ideas about Black people, I was sort of discovering and chronicling the racist ideas Americans had produced over the lifetime of this country.
What were some of the ideas that you had to dispel from your own interior world?
So I think two probably major ones, and I mean, there were quite a few, but I think two major ones are two ideas that are extremely popular. And the first is that there's a such thing as an academic achievement gap, and that Black children are intellectually inferior, and their intellectual inferiority, or they're not achieving at the academic level of white children's because of their environment, as of course assimilationists would argue. But then if you asked the question, so why is it that, like, what evidence do you have that suggests that Black children are not achieving at the level of white children? The evidence is standardized tests. And then when we unpack the history of standardized tests, and when we realize that standardized tests were created by people who wanted to prove that Black people were not only intellectually inferior, but intellectually inferior because of their inferior genes, we begin to sort of realize that, you know, sort of who and what purpose was behind these tests. When we also realize that, if we really think about it, intelligence is as subjective as beauty. Mm. So trying to standardize something as subjective as intelligence or beauty, you're ordinarily going to create a hierarchy, a hierarchy that is going to benefit a particular group of people. And so that was one of the ideas that I held until I, you know, really took and began to understand the history of standardized tests. Another idea is that Black neighborhoods are more dangerous, which is another very popular idea, and it's based on our conception that arrest and incarceration rates are indicative of actual crime rates, even though many of us have committed crimes before and never been arrested. And so it's not indicative of actual crime rates. It's only indicative of arrest rates. And typically the communities with the higher levels of arrest and incarceration, those are the communities that we're more likely to put police in. And when you have more police in a community, you're going to have more arrests. You have more arrests in a community, you have more levels of incarceration. And so it creates this sort of vicious cycle that's continuing to this day.
Right. And that's not helped by when the news is reporting on those arrests of the newspaper and the media, and they're reinforcing some of that bias.
Yes. And you know, I think another sign of it is our conception that Black neighborhoods are more dangerous because they're more violent crime. But what we don't realize is that there's actually a better correlation between unemployment rates and violent crime than there is Blackness or Black people in violent crime. And so we see, according to data, that there's actually, you know, no matter the racial groups, you have higher levels of unemployment, you're going to have higher levels of violent crime. And so, but that doesn't cause us to realize that there's no such thing as a dangerous Black neighborhood. You know, even though we should, it doesn't cause us to realize that it's actually better to describe a such thing as a dangerous unemployed neighborhood.
Yeah, that's not the narrative that's getting pushed.
No.
Well, instead of saying achievement gap, and what's the approach then that's the anti-racial approach to children that are having trouble in school? Like, where's the starting point for making sure that every child can have a decent education?
I think first and foremost for us to, in taking a standardized test and thereby the academic achievement gap out of the equation, we then are, in order to take it out the equation, we have to reconceive of what intelligence is. So I think we begin to realize that students, that it may be the case that that poor Black children, that child at that under-resourced school, their intelligence is different than the intelligence of a child at that rich, white, over-resourced school. And so for us to have the diversity of mind to understand the ways in which their intelligence is different. So to give an example, typically these kids are very intelligent about understanding all of the verbal and nonverbal, mathematical and non-mathematical equations of their own everyday life. And, you know, that's typically what most people have to do. Like, people become pretty much experts on their own experience. But that doesn't, of course, translate. If your experience has not been standardized, then, of course, it's not going to translate into standardized tests. So I think getting away from that, and I think, but then again, there certainly is gaps in resources allocated to different schools, which to me is a problem. Those gaps don't necessarily create inferior students, but they certainly do give certain students more opportunities. Like, so you can literally, you know, not necessarily be inferior, but still have less opportunities. And I don't think that's one of the things that people understand. I think, you know, we just assume that, you know, these under-resourced schools are creating inferior children, when in fact they're just creating a scenario in which these kids have less opportunities. And so I think, you know, to equalize, as people have been trying to do for a very long time, to, you know, truly create equal opportunity, because we say education is the ladder to success in this country, but then our schools are blatantly unequal.
Now, one of the things that your book talks about that flies in the face of a lot of understanding about how racism can be overcome or defeated is you talk about that education and presenting the facts doesn't persuade away racism. And a lot of things I've heard is that ignorance and hate is where racism comes from. And that's been like the, and you say that's folklore, and it's a really, it's a very powerful thing that you're talking about here. That's a paradigm shift, I think. And maybe you can, get to the root of that. So the idea being that if hate and ignorance is not what's producing racism, it's not just a matter of getting the facts out and just telling people in power who really don't care about changing things, like, here's the facts and now you're not ignorant anymore and everything's going to change. It's seeing it in a very different way. Maybe you can talk about the crux of the problem there.
Well, yeah, and I think that's one of the, of course, I think one of the best aspects of history is history gives people in every generation a guide of what they can do and what they should do and how they can create a different world using lessons of history. And I think we've been taught a history that states that really the origins are ignorance and hate. And so what that then means is it causes us to be like, okay, we just need to educate people and create these love circles, and then we'll be able to reduce racism. And we've been trying to do that for hundreds of years, and it certainly has not worked. And so at some point we need to, realize that those strategies have not worked. And I sort of laid out in Stanford in the beginning precisely why. Because I ended up, again, distinguishing between what I call the producers of racist ideas and the consumers of racist ideas. So you can educate away the racist ideas of a consumer of racist ideas, right? But when it comes to the producers of racist ideas, who are producing these ideas to justify existing racist policies that typically benefit them, like, it is not strategically wise to spend time trying to educate away their racist ideas, because they're not coming necessarily out of ignorance. It's almost equivalent to us trying to educate a business executive of a company that produces harmful products that those products are harmful. Mm-hmm. That executive was there at the creation of that harmful product. They know as much as anybody how harmful that product is. They are the reason why the company is putting out a marketing campaign saying that the products are not harmful. So trying to educate them doesn't make much sense. They already know, but they have a specific interest in trying to convince you and I that those products are not harmful. And so instead we have to force that company to stop more or less producing those harmful products. And there's no way we can persuade or convince them to do so.
Yeah, that is a really important point. And on the consumer side, in terms of, in a sense, stopping the cycle. So when people who are in power, the small elite at the top who are in power, putting out these policies of self-interest, and then the consumers are eating up the myths and the folklore of racist ideas, education can still come in and say, can bust up the myths and can spread the truth, and that can break some of the cycles and can do some good. But it's not until the root is pulled out, till the problem is pulled out by the roots. And how do you get to that point where you can persuade them? You talk about intelligent self-interest, and maybe you can go into a little bit of that. Or how do you ever get to the actual root?
I think when it comes to power and people in positions of power, historically, they have, power responds to power. And so, power has been willing to eliminate racist policies when basically another form of power basically forced them to, because it created a set of circumstances in which maintaining or defending those racist policies were no longer in their own self-interest. And so typically, for instance, protest pressure, has done that. If you're, you're a business and, you've been excluding Black workers and suddenly people have boycotted your business and they're going to boycott it until you start hiring Black people and now you're losing a ton of money. Okay, maybe I need to stop this policy because I'm losing a ton of money. And so, of course, the business owner is going to say, oh, I've seen the light. I now recognize the importance and the equality of humans. So I'm going to sort of now start hiring Black workers. But in reality, it's they don't want to continue to lose any more money. And so they'll change their policies. And, you know, people have done that over the course of history. But I think and that's more of a temporary solution because oftentimes, when that pressure sort of dies down or they don't feel as if there will be a reaction if they reinstitute that policy, if, again, that policy benefits them, then they'll just sort of reinstitute it. And so then you'll have to do another round of sort of protest pressure or lobbying or other form of sort of pressure. And so really, you know, the long-term solution is getting people who are anti-racist in positions of power, people who are not going to institute racist policies, you know, people who are going to truly try to create equal opportunity in this country.
And you talked about the ongoing failure of the three oldest, most popular strategies Americans have used to root out these ideas. One of them we talked about already, the educational persuasion. But the other two I thought were really, really potent too, self-sacrifice and uplift suasion. And if you don't mind going into those a little bit, I think that would be really helpful.
So I think as it relates to self-sacrifice, mm-hmm. I think one of the, I think, overstated elements of racial reform, the racial reform discourse, is this idea that white people or even elite, Black elites, let's say, or particular groups of people have benefited from racism. And so when you look at it, white people, let's say, in general, on average, have benefited from racism. You know, there are certain set of, there's a reason why 15 Black, white people have 15 times more wealth than Black people in this country. So certainly overall, on average, white people have benefited. But then when you actually break down white people into, let's say, classes or even gendered groups, then that actually, it sort of changes. Because to a large extent, there are many ways in which the white middle class has not benefited from racism. And so we've seen this, for instance, over the last 40 years, in which there's this growing amount of income inequality between the middle and upper classes, and the white middle class has largely suffered. And they've largely suffered because they voted for politicians who were telling them that there was an affirmative action problem, a welfare problem, a crime problem, and they ended up voting for these people. And all the while, these people were cutting taxes for the rich and, you know, doing other things that increased income inequality. But these people were told that they actually have to sacrifice in order to be anti-racist. No, actually, you know, it's actually in their own self-interest to basically create an egalitarian society, because racism has informed income inequality. Racism has informed sexism. Racism has informed ethnocentrism and all of these other forms of oppression and bigotry. They have basically been married to racism from the beginning. And so really, you know, if you're against any form of bigotry, it is actually in your own self-interest. If you're against any form of hierarchy, it's actually in your self-interest to be an anti-racist.
Mm. Right. And it really goes back to when we're talking about racism, I tend to think of it as a construct that really can affect people that look a certain way and not affect people that look a different way. And so when we're talking about race, we're talking about, you know, deep prejudice and discrimination, but it is based on how you look. And we are still talking about a construct, but we're talking about a construct where if you look this way, you have to check this box. And if you look this way, you have to check this other box. And it actually doesn't even matter where you came from originally. It matters how somebody thinks that you look, right? And so, but it's still we're still calling it racism, and it's still a it's still a real thing, and it's still something that you have to root out, because if you don't root it out, everybody suffers. Like you're saying, that you can't. It is in all of our best interest to make sure that people are treated fairly, no matter what they look like, no matter where they came from, no matter what gender, no matter what preference, sexual preference, or whatever, because everybody loses except for these couple people at the top who are calling all the shots and making all the rules. And I think that that's this, you know, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but when white people have a scarcity mindset, that so-called equally or leveling the playing field will somehow take from them, that's part of the myth that is getting propagated by the people who are setting the rules.
Yes, and typically the people who are setting the rules are very, very, very wealthy. And typically these whites who have this fear of the leveling the playing field, they're not looking at the leveling of their playing field with those very, very wealthy people. They're looking at the leveling of the playing field with poor people. And so they're only thinking about what they can lose as opposed to what they can gain. And they've been taught to do that by those very people, you know, who are at the top, who don't want them to, of course, gain, and who want them to ally with them, which will then allow them to continue to have so much more than that person who is fearful of leveling the play field. I mean, it, you know, all of this comes back to ideas and ideology and what you've been taught and what you think. And that's why, you know, I thought writing this book was so critical, you know, because, you know, what we challenge and what we spend our time thinking is the problem is based on a set of ideas. And so we have been taught that the black poor or poor people are the problem. Of course, we're going to, you know, vote for politicians who see them as a problem. We're going to challenge them, even though these people are not the problem. You know, they are largely the victims, just as to a certain extent middle income people are, you know, of policies that are benefiting a very small select group of people.
Well, in the case of, like, if you were in charge, let's say, as a mayor of a small city with a lot of urban poor and a lot of unemployment, what would be the thing that you would want to do to make sure people had it better in, say, 5 years? Like, what do you think were some of the changes you would like to make?
I mean, first and foremost, I would sort of recognize that the causes of inequities, and so inequities like the disproportionate amount of black people who are impoverished or even unemployed, are not because of there being something wrong with black people. You know, it's because of a disproportionate lack of opportunities that these people have. And so, you know, as a person, I would then seek to figure out ways to equalize the opportunities, to bring these people opportunities. And I would be razor focused on that and changing whatever policies in the city or in the area that is basically limiting the amount of opportunities that these people have. I would investigate local businesses and corporations to see if they have some semblance of racial parity, you know, on their staffs. Are they overrepresented with white staffs? And then when they tell me it's because black workers are not qualified, I would not believe and agree with that racist idea. And I would encourage them and figure out ways to compel them to equalize their staffs. And so, I mean, you know, and this is, of course, specifically as it relates to employment. And I think if we increase the employment levels in black communities, just like if we were to do that in any community, it will decrease the amount of violent crime. And so, you know, it will affect other areas. I would figure out, of course, ways to better and improve the educational, the amount of money and resources that are being provided to the schools on the pretext that these kids are intelligent. And I think more resources will give them a better opportunity to show their intelligence. Mm. So I think that that's sort of some of the things that I would be.
Yeah. Yes. And it seems like when people are given the opportunities, they make use of them. But when the going idea is that they will squander the opportunities and we should just put those opportunities elsewhere, it's like a self-perpetuating, a self-fulfilling prophecy or a self-perpetuating idea that just continues to gain like negative steam. And I see what you mean that.
Yeah, and that's not to say, anti-racist, that's not to say that they don't think that there are Black people out there who are lazy or who want to commit crimes or who are not hard workers. But it is to say that there's no one has ever proven that there are more lazy Black people than there are white people, or no more criminally minded, dangerous, angry, sort of immoral Black people than there are white people. Mm-hmm. And so when you equalize the opportunities between two equal groups, then those two groups will excel and take advantage of those opportunities at similar levels, meaning some people will take advantage of them and some people won't.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, you teach right now, is your book going to be used as curriculum for your students?
So yeah, I'm actually teaching it right now in one of my classes, and I'm actually excited because in the summer the book is going to be coming out on paperback, and so that's going to make it even more accessible for students and even regular readers, because of course it'll be cheaper and thereby more accessible to even more readers.
Yeah, I was thinking that is the perfect, it's about the right size. It's the size of my textbooks I remember in college. And I think this will be one of those seminal works that'll have to be required reading for American history, but of course, for Black studies. And I just wanted to end, if I could, on a quote and how you end your book, but also if you have any final words after I read this quote. And again, I'm just so honored that you would come on this program. And I think this is to me required reading for any American to understand race, and because there isn't any excuse to not understand about race in this country. It's right in front of us all the time, and there are a lot of things we have to rectify and improve. And it's not going to happen by pretending the problems don't exist or that they haven't started a long time ago. But I'm going to read this last bit that you have. It's a very hopeful final word in your book, and then I'll leave the last word up to you. So you end by saying, "No power lasts forever. There will come a time when Americans will realize that the only thing wrong with Black people is that they think something is wrong with Black people. There will come a time when racist ideas will no longer obstruct us from seeing the complete and utter abnormality of racial disparities. There will come a time when we will love humanity, when we will gain the courage to fight for an equitable society for our beloved humanity, knowing intelligently that when we fight for humanity, we are fighting for ourselves. There will come a time, maybe, just maybe, that time is now." And so I just thank you for your work. I think it's very powerful. I can't wait to read all of the rest of it, because I read some of the beginning and a lot of the end, but I really appreciate that. And if you have anything else that you wanted to say, I invite you to say that.
Well, no, I think we covered a lot, and I'm just honored to be on your show and to be able to, speak to you and speak to your listeners.
If you've listened to the show, but you'd like more information about someone mentioned or a book or a website, all that can be found in the detailed show notes I create for every show. A link to those show notes can be found at sparkmymuse.com for this episode, or you can find them directly at the support page at patreon.com/sparkmymuse.